Welcome back, folks. This is our second part of a two-part series on Richard Grissom Jr. It's a horrible story. It's every young woman's nightmare come true when she has her first apartment. We have two detectives with us who worked this case, and we're going to hear tonight the second part. The last part we heard about the investigation and the crimes. Tonight, like Law and Order, we're going to hear about the prosecution.
You put $50,000 in cash money in the spot, right?
300 Quaker, probably in the spot. What would you do?
They steal the toll or they turn it to cash.
Okay, I'm on the northbound access. Just right at the light.
Look, how big, Carl? What the hell can you do? I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, folks. Welcome to the beautiful studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show, Studio 4, right here in Midtown, Kansas City. We're inside the classic old Ice House building. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, we're back for the second half of the Richard Grissom story. We have with us my good friend, Joe Langer, and Tom Robinson, both retired. Tommy's retired from the Kansas City Police Department, and Joe is retired from the Leawood Police Department. Both of them were assigned to this Richard Grissom case, assigned to the Metro Squad. We explained last time about how the Metro Squad was formed and how it works. It's a kind of an esoteric term, if you will. It's not something that you normally hear about, and especially in huge big cities like Chicago and New York and L.A. They all have their own resources usually. But here in Kansas City, we have all these suburban cities and rural areas that are close by, and they need to get help from other jurisdictions. So this is a way to get help. You know, why don't Tommy, tell me a little bit about, or tell the people, I already know a little bit about you. Tell me, I've known Tommy for a long time. Tell the folks a little bit about your history with the police department and how you ended up being assigned to the Metro Squad in the end.
Well, I spent 25 years with the Kansas City Police Department from 1971 to 1996. Started off as everyone does in patrol, and after a few years in patrol, I became interested in investigations and had the opportunity to start off in the burglary unit and spent time there and had opportunities. I was fortunate enough to make some good cases and had opportunities to move to other divisions within the police department, spent time in narcotics and vice, time in robbery and the fugitive apprehension unit. So I had a pretty well-rounded career. And at some point, I don't remember what year, I had the opportunity to go to Metro Squad training and get on that team. And, you know, that means you're on the roster and cases don't come often, but they do come from time to time. And so I was very fortunate to get called up on this squad and wind up partnering with Joe Langer.
How did you meet Gary Jenkins then? You worked in the same years, 71 to 96?
Well, he was in hiding all those years. we come across him once in a while.
Folks, let me tell you, and I told Joe the same thing. I say this about Tommy. See, I worked in intelligence, and we don't really work cases per se. We go out and gather information, and so when you find out about something, or you want to find out about something, or you want to get something done, these are the kind of guys you go to because they'll get it done, people. They will get it done. One way or the other, they will get it done.
And conversely, if you have someone in your district when you're a district officer or a detective that you're interested in, the intelligence division was an excellent resource, especially organized crime figures, but they had files on a lot of other career criminals. So.
Now, and you said in the episode before, we talked about the Metro Division, and there's 30 Metro departments. And so what you have is an officer assigned from every one of those Metro departments to kind of make it that division up.
That's the available roster.
The roster.
From all the departments. And some departments.
How do they select those guys? I mean, like, how do they end up coming to you and saying, Tommy, we think you're the guy? You've got a caseload already of current things that you're investigating, cases you're working on under your department, probably, right?
Actually, they have a public information officer, and there would be three or four public information officers, and they would rotate the metro squads. And if you're a public information officer, when they activate a squad and it's your squad, then you determine from the agency that's putting the investigation together how many people they need. And then you, as a public information officer, you call the various departments and see, you know, how many men you can get, and men or women you can get, and how soon they could be there if you know, if you're going to call them out. You give them the time to report. And once you got that commitment, then you take that roster and you close it down because you've got the squad you need.
Each squad will have a different amount of officers assigned to it, depending on what the anticipated needs are, I would imagine.
Yes, and
the type of case that it is.
Right, and quite frankly, if you're a public information officer, you may recognize which departments, you know, are going to have more experienced detectives to call upon. You know, Joe, if I was a public information officer, if I could get Joe, I always tried to get Joe.
Yeah, you know the reputations of the different people. And then, as I think Joe said last time, if it's like a narcotics-based case, if it's some kind of a horrible murder, there's some kind of a narcotics angle, you'll go to try to get people who are familiar with narcotics. If it's maybe some kind of a burglary or a professional criminal kind of a thing, a mob thing, then you would go get people who may have more expertise in that. Like on the KCPD, you would know who would have more experience with those kinds of particular things than who may not.
And I probably failed to mention some of the agencies, the federal agencies, also send people to help us with the metro squad.
No, did they? I didn't realize that.
The Highway Patrol, we had investigators from the Highway Patrol, some very good investigators that help with cases. And
yeah, especially if you were going out state, you know, KBI and Kansas Highway Patrol, especially, you like had something down in Wichita and you know, maybe in a rural county, especially, you would want the KBI on board. You would want a state trooper on board.
Well, and the KBI was a member. They are members of the Metro Squad, so they would get called regularly too.
Yeah.
To even ones in the metro area.
And KBI stands for
Kansas Bureau of Investigation.
That's what I thought.
So, Joe, tell us a little bit about your career.
Well, I had 29 years with Leawood. I spent 2 years in patroller uniform when I started. I was.
What years did you serve? Sorry.
29 years.
No.
From 1982 to 2011. And I spent 2 years in patrol. I was a detective for 27 years. I was on the Metro Squad for 25 years. I was fortunate enough to work early in my career with Tommy Robinson. I met him on, it was a receiving stolen property, burglary. It was a whole bunch of stuff altogether. It was a big case. I got Tommy and he put me under his wing and he taught me a lot and helped my career tremendously throughout my career. But just knowing him helped me open a lot of doors in Kansas City, Missouri PD.
That's how it works, isn't it?
That's right.
You got to know the people, the right people, like I said.
You know, I will say he's probably, if not the best, one of the best they've ever had over there. So
that was his specialty, was those burglary rings, those professional criminals that worked those burglary rings. I remember that. And it'd always be maybe some kind of quasi mob or, you know, some influencer, maybe they do the fencing or whatever. But he had that knack. Everybody didn't have this knack to go after those rings and start taking them down.
He taught me a lot. So, and he put together a lot of great cases that I don't think most people could. So, but I spent, I went to Metro Squad School in 1985. So I'd been a detective for about a year. I stayed on the Metro Squad till I retired. So I was on the Metro Squad about 25 years. And we got to work quite a few together as partners and worked out real well. I was able to be on some high profile cases that came in on the Metro Squad. They were cases that were very important, had a lot of public, you know, the public was very interested in it. And as in this case, I don't think there's been a case in the Kansas City area, or at least that the Metro Squad has handled, that has had this much public interest.
I don't remember one that was any hotter than this when people were really scared. There was one, you remember Vincent 2X Lee, the guy that was going around, had a 22 pistol and killed clerks
in the convenience stores.
And they killed those two kids downtown at Radio Shack at 11th, 12th and Grand, 13th and Grand Radio Shack. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
That may have been a little bit hotter for a while, right. But this one here was one hot mama. I think mainly because of the victims.
Right.
I think so many people felt so vulnerable, and especially they were these nice young girls that lived out in the suburbs, and that's just, we're a little more used to this over in the city, and that guy was killing people more around in the city.
Yeah.
And so it was a hot one, hot mama. It costs a lot of money to do that. How did they finance this?
Well, how the Metro Squad works, and Tommy touched on it, is that the departments, the host department, in this case, it would have been two agencies, Lenexa and Overland Park, have, I think there was between 30 and 40 investigators assigned to this case. And they're all from different jurisdictions. Some have multiple detectives from some jurisdictions that are larger. Now, the only thing that the host agencies paid for would be lunch, and at that time it was $7.50 for lunch and $10 for dinner. So it would be $17.50 per person, per Metro Squad member that worked. All the overtime, and there's always a lot of overtime on these Metro Squads.
Yeah, because when you start that first week, you work your leads out until you're done with the leads.
Right. All the overtime is paid for by the agencies where the detectives or the investigators come from. So if I had 30 hours of overtime, Overland Park or Lenexa would not pay that. Leewood would. So they don't pay for any overtime except for their own people. And that is a tremendous financial break for departments, especially smaller, not only Leewood, when we've had Metro Squads, you get 30 people, seasoned investigators, the next day or even sometimes the day of the murder to start working this, and it only costs us $15 a person.
Right. And then they may work 12, 14 hours that first day too.
Yeah.
So.
And with all the experience. So it's a great concept that Sergeant Hatfield and
Major Hatfield. Elza Hatfield. The first time I ever got assigned to a special squad, he was the guy in charge. I got a story about him, but we won't go down that path. He was a character.
Well, they were well before their time. Hatfield and
Clarence Kelly.
And the chief from Sugar Creek was early in there, too.
Yeah, Earl Connor.
Earl Connor. Yeah, he was one of the.
And actually, the chief in Overland Park was Myron's Cave. So. You know, they had a lot of people that were very smart in how they organized it, but it also had dual jurisdiction. They would try to keep an officer from Missouri and Kansas together. So if you had to go into Missouri, you had jurisdiction, which you had anyway. The state legislatures had signed an agreement that if you're working a Metro Squad case, you had jurisdiction.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
They had that worked out legally. But they still tried to keep Missouri and Kansas officers, one each, on a team, because a Missouri officer would know more about if you go over to Missouri, and likewise if you're in Kansas. So it really works well. Now, in this case, there was lots of money that was being spent on this investigation. They had DNA. That was, I don't even know how much that would have cost, because that was in its infancy. I mean, now it would be much at all, but back then it was a ton of money. And I believe, I've heard, was not actually told or read this somewhere, but the chief, Scaife and Chief Foster from Overland Park and Lenexa went to their city councils and received $1 million each for this investigation. Now, I don't know if they paid it all. But I'm sure they paid quite a bit of it.
But they were ready to spend it all.
They were ready.
People were scared.
And the host agencies pay for some other expenses. I think they pay for the gas for all the cars.
Right.
You gas up at
the... Oh, yeah, that's right. Casey, if you were over your car, KCPD, it would pay for that gas.
And any travel, and in this case, there was quite a bit of travel expense.
Right, they pay for all the travel. Anything other than the salary and overtime.
Yeah.
You know, they pay for.
I suppose like your mundane, shall we say, lab stuff. I think Johnson County has a pretty good lab out there, so Johnson County...
Oh, yeah.
Sheriff's office would have handled all that expense and put their lab people on it.
Right. And they had an excellent lab at the time, too.
Was there a particular place then that you guys as Metro and as you would kind of meet up? You have 30, 40, 50 investigators. I mean, and you're talking this is in 1989, so they've got to get a photocopier going to get everybody case files and information, right? They're handing out these literally 3x5 cards. Where do you guys all get together to go, here's where things are at?
Well, every morning, and I remember the first day the Metro Squad was activated in this investigation, and I saw Tommy, and we told the personnel guy we wanted to be partners. So he knew we would do good work, so he put us together. But usually what happens is the host agency, in this case, there were two. So Overland Park was the first one. It was held at their police department.
Because they had the first murder. So they,
right. I'm assuming that's how that came about. But then they have a big briefing room that we used. And, you know, the first day you all meet in the briefing room, you sit around. They have a big briefing on what's happened. They brief you on everything they have. And in this point, they knew Richard, or we felt Richard Grissom was the guy we needed to talk to. He was on the run. They had done a great deal of background on him already. They had found out that he had murdered an elderly lady in Lansing, Kansas, when he was 16 or 15 or 16. He had beat her to death with a railroad spike after he burglarized her house. He only spent 2 years in custody, and when he became an adult, they let him out. He also had a background of fraud and forgery, and every time he had been caught, at least on the fraud and forgeries, he usually would confess. But he was, you know, he was starting to, they had a profile done on him. He was adopted by his family. His mother was from Korea, and his father was a military serviceman. He never knew. I don't think the mother really knew who he was. I think she, wasn't she a prostitute?
I believe so, yeah.
Can you say where they lived, where he grew up?
Well, actually, he was adopted by another military family, as far as I know, in Korea. And he was brought back here when he was young.
Was he part Korean and half, probably a African-American soldier that was stationed in Korea? Was his father more than likely, and his mother... probably was a prostitute.
Right. He was biracial. He was we believe he was half Korean and half African American. They just, to their credit, they had lots of information on Grissom when we started. And they went through all that. They went through all the leads, the girls disappearing in Lenexa, what happened in Overland Park. They even had talked with people that were at parties that had seen Richard talking with Teresa Brown and Christina Roush at a pool party earlier. I can't remember how much earlier in the future in the back was, but so they really had done a great job, and we just needed to find Grissom. And they put teams out. Everybody was looking for him. The media was just all over everyone. If a team would, I mean, they parked out in the parking lot of the Overland Park Police Department. So when a team would leave, they would follow.
They'd follow them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
And it was hot.
Yeah, it was. And then this is kind of a funny little story. But one of the detectives, we ordered some ribs from Arthur Bryant's. And you know how they package them. And so in a brown bag. And they came back and they were carrying these ribs, and they had some sauce on the outside.
Show some red peeking through. And I see where we're going here.
The media.
Policemen. You got to have that gallows humor to survive.
They were putting their $15 to good use.
Yeah, the media. Oh, what do you got there? He said, well, we just got some evidence. We can't talk about it. It was our rib dinner for the day. But, it was just everywhere. They were everywhere. I think like the second day we get a call. Overland Park or Lenexa gets a call from a girl living in Chicago. The girl says, I hear you're looking for Richard Grissom. I know him from college. I've got friends that know him. I was contacted by a friend that say you're looking for him. And yes, we are. I know where he is. He's in Corpus Christi, Texas. Well, how do you know that? Well, I've talked with him. He's telling me he's in Corpus Christi. He's out on, what was the name of the...
Port Aransas
Beach. Yeah, Port Aransas Beach, and he likes it down there. He's having a ball, and he calls me daily, basically. It was decided we would send a team of investigators to Chicago to stay with this girl. There was a team that was going to go down to Corpus Christi to try and locate and find Grissom, and then Grissom also had a girlfriend, is it in Cincinnati or Nashville? I think it was Nashville. Nashville. And we had a team go out there to follow her around, just in case he was lying to this girl. And so that was decided what we were going to do. And they really used the media a little bit. They said that, because the media knew we were going somewhere, that there were people going places. And the media said, we think he's in Florida.
So obviously people were calling around who knew people that knew him and
right.
reporting back to him. And then they were maybe calling you.
Well, yeah.
But there was word going around. So it could have gotten back to him that you right. guys were sent to Florida as a good idea.
Yeah. So they used Florida. And then they assigned Tommy and I to go to Corpus Christi to try and locate him.
No, was that after the officers came back from Chicago?
No.
Or at the same time?
At the same time. The team, one team of two went to Chicago.
So they're sitting up there with her, hoping he calls back
right.
in.
Monitoring the conversations. And then the team in Nashville, kind of keeping an eye on the girlfriend there. Tommy and I, flew down to Corpus Christi. Grissom was the type of a guy that would go to all the hot spots. You know, he would go to the high-end nightclubs. He'd go to where the action is, where there's girls, lots of night spots, dancing, everything, and the beach. He liked to go to the beach. We hooked up with the Corpus Christi Police Department. In fact, he was the commander of the intelligence unit or organized crime unit. We may have worked with the marshals also. But I remember, anyway.
Yeah, and those smaller PDs like that, lots of times they'll have a small intelligence unit, and that'll be kind of a catch-all. And like our intelligence unit, that's one thing that we did. And we're a member of LEIU, it's Law Enforcement Intelligence
right.
Units. And so if another department wanted a question answered in Kansas City, they might go to their intelligence unit, who will then call us because mm-hmm. we know each other through, we have a book, and we all... You know, we got credibility with each other, and you don't, especially when anything's a little bit sensitive.
Right.
And you really want the job done with some focus. You just don't call 911 in that city.
Right.
You just don't call their burglary unit and talk to the secretary and then see if you can't talk to somebody that gives a shit, to be quite honest. So intelligence unit will care because they're used to doing those kinds of things. So that's probably what you ran into down there.
And the squad had really done a great job delving into his background. You know,
sounds like it. God, you knew everything about him, man.
Yeah, we knew the kind of places he liked to frequent. He was kind of a physical fitness nut. He loved to play racquetball, and he was a well-built, handsome guy. And the girls, kind of swooned over him when he go to places.
How'd they do that, Tommy? They just keep interviewing different people, anybody that knew him or never heard of him or was around him.
That plus the tips started coming in. You know, like you said, this is every girl's worst nightmare, and some of these girls that knew him and had met him started calling in. They probably thought, that could have been me.
Was his picture in the paper by then?
There was local media coverage certainly here at the time, and but did the coverage get more larger nationally? So it's, you know, that the friend in Chicago probably realizing he's telling her some alternate story, and then maybe sees a news story before she reaches out to you guys.
No, she was contacted by a friend that said we were looking for Richard.
Okay,
and then she said, "Well, I'm talking to him," so she called. And I don't remember getting too much national attention.
I don't think there was at that time. Yeah. You know, of course, it's a lot different environment now.
You're right. Back then, it probably was.
But you go down to Corpus Christi, and there's probably a lot of nightclubs.
Right.
Oh, yeah, you're down there by Padre Island.
Right. Well, and we went to several of them for a long time.
So you guys would walk in, and you were younger at the time.
Yeah.
On official business.
Yeah. You know, and every time Richard would call the girl in Chicago, the team would call us.
Oh, so he was continuing to call her.
Yeah,
all right, cool.
Yeah. And he would say, like on the 4th of July, we were there. He was at a 4th of July fireworks celebration. So we hustled out there, but, I mean, there was probably 30,000 people there watching.
We're missing the big clue.
Yeah, missing the big clue.
The car, the missing car from Grandview, you know, with it. When we caught him, he had a stolen car.
Oh, well, see, I didn't know about that. Did you know that he had a car stolen from Grandview then?
Not at that time.
Oh, okay.
We thought he probably had one stolen from somewhere out there, but because he left his car at the apartment complex in Grandview.
Oh.
But we were never able to track down a stolen car that, you know, we felt could have been it or we could have been watching for it. And sure enough, he had a stolen car from Grandview.
Well, but in June... or July, if you will, of 1989, I'm sure South Padre Islands and all that area was a big mecca of people coming from all over the country, so you wouldn't be able to narrow it down by having them spot in Missouri license plate.
Correct.
Right. But it was the type of car. I mean, you don't know if you had ever seen the car. It was just something that we didn't get, and, you know, nobody's fault. It was just...
just one of those things, right?
Yeah, it was stolen a little bit away from where he last was seen. So in Grandview, they did a great job because they looked at his car and they were able to put together they saw credit cards in there. They found jewelry in there that were the girls. And,
oh, this was a Toyota.
Yeah, this was his car. He had, because the cops came. A manager, actually it was a maintenance guy, became suspicious of him. He called the manager and she said, "I think that's Richard Grissom. They're looking for him." So they called 911. Grandview came out. He took off and they found his car. And in it was a treasure trove of evidence for court and for his prosecution. I mean, they had jewelry of both girls. They had identification cards of at least one of the girls, different driver's licenses of his again. Just a lot of things that really assisted in the prosecution.
This was a case built on a mound of circumstantial evidence,
right.
It sounds to me like.
Yeah. Anyway, we're down there. We haven't located them. Then we get a call from the team in Chicago, and they say that he wants the girl to fly down to Dallas and meet him.
Oh, that'll be nice.
Yeah. So
she's cooperating. Apparently.
She is cooperating. She said she would come down. We got the call on the 6th, about 7 at night, call saying that he's going to be at the Dallas airport probably about 10 o'clock. That's when her plane comes in from Chicago. So they said for us to take the first plane out of Corpus Christi to Dallas and get with we had made arrangements with the FBI and their surveillance unit to surveil the gate where it was coming in and hopefully arrest him before the plane even comes in.
She actually was coming in. They put her on the plane.
And we had
a team went with her.
Yeah. There was another little side story to that. One of the detectives in the team called. We talked about what we were going to do the night before. And he said, "Now make sure you tell the FBI I'm wearing a tan suit." I said, "I know what you look like, but okay, I'll do that." 4 in the morning. I mean, we got to get up at 5, and we didn't probably get to bed till midnight. The phone rings at 3 or 4 in the morning, and I answer it, and he says, "Joe." I said, "Yeah." He said, I'm not wearing that tan suit. I'm going to wear a blue one instead, or vice versa, whatever.
Was he a light-skinned black guy?
And I said, Tom, I told him, I'm going to tell the FBI to shoot you
on sight. Said, the guy in the blue suit.
The guy in the blue suit.
Well, he probably hadn't gotten much sleep either.
No. And, you know,
especially at that time of night when he's running around trying to get a tan suit in Chicago. Yeah.
Really. And I tell you, everybody was excited, you know, and he just wanted to make sure.
And that's the deal with these things. Right. Everybody gets tense and they overthink things. They go to such huge lengths because they don't want to be the one that screws it up.
Right.
I don't want to be the one that screws this up.
And he's worried about protecting this young lady.
Right. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. He was concerned about that. So anyway, me and Tommy get to Dallas and, get with the FBI. Now, in the meantime, before we left on the plane to go to Dallas, we were contacted by the Metro Squad. And they had told us that there was a FBI agent that was a profiler for the area that was coming down to Dallas. And that they wanted him to interview Richard, because they said he has told them he's in his head and he thinks he can get a confession. And Richard always confessed on smaller crimes like forgery, fraud, stuff like that, thefts. He never did confess to the murder of the old lady in Lansing.
When he was 16.
Yeah.
You wanted to interview him, interrogate him. You wanted to get that confession, didn't you?
We're kind of griping to the FBI in Dallas. They picked us up at the airport. He said, well, one of you has to be in there. He said, it's a homicide interview.
That's true. He said, by himself.
One has to be in there. I don't know how you guys are going to decide that, but you guys decide. And while we were waiting at the airport looking for Richard to show up at the gate, we were getting calls from the FBI office, or the FBI was getting calls from their office saying that the agent that just came in from Kansas City was calling. They thought he was just wanting a ride, wanting them to pick him up. Well, they said, just tell him to wait. We'll pick him up after we arrest the guy. Well, what had happened is when he got off his plane, Richard wasn't the brightest bulb in the box. He went to the Kansas City arrival gate. I don't know why, but that's when the FBI agent saw him.
Oh, FBI agent had gotten to the airport and he sees him, but he's at,
and he's calling for backup.
Oh, my God.
Kind of ignoring
him. And you're thinking, we'll get him.
Well,
you knew what time the flights were coming in. You weren't waiting to the last minute to get there.
I don't think so. I think Richard just went to, he was thinking in his mind she was coming from Kansas City.
Yeah, and you were at the Chicago arrival gate.
Right.
You guys were. And the FBI agent was the Kansas City arrival gate.
Oh, he had just come in off the plane to come down.
Oh, I see. He came in from Kansas City, and there Grissom is standing there.
Right.
He's trying to casually walk by like, I know who that guy is.
Oh, my God.
So he's trying to follow him without being too conspicuous because he wants backup to grab him. Because Richard's a big guy.
Yeah.
Athletic. And, he can't get us because we're saying, you know, just tell him to wait. And so he grabs a uniform officer a police officer at the airport, and they arrest him and bring him in. And they have a huge facility, big airport, police department.
Oh, yeah. Dallas, Fort Worth.
Yeah. They bring him in. Tommy and I, they bring us to the airport headquarters. They said, which one of you guys going in? And I said, well, Tommy, you should go in. Because he said, well, why? And I said, well, you've been on the job longer and you got more experience, you're better at it than me. Well, that ain't right. And I said, well, I think you should. He said, no. He says, we got to do it fair. He said, let's flip a coin.
Tommy, you said, let's flip a coin.
Yeah. So I said, well, okay. So we flip a coin and I win. And then Tommy says, how about 2 out of 3? I said, no. So he lost the flip. but this was
at the airport, actually.
Right. They have a police department in the airport.
So how'd that work with this FBI agent? Was he really think he was in his head? Did he really have that much skill?
Well, by the time, and Tommy and I had talked about this before I went in, is we thought that profilers mainly are used to watch interviews and look at how they're reacting to things and then give you ideas of how to go about it. Well, that isn't what was going to happen. So I went in, and he had already started the interview. He had been in there probably about 15 or 20 minutes. When I got in, they were talking mainly about the girl in Wichita. And we had the body on the girl in Wichita, and he had mutilated the body. And he was pretty embarrassed, I think, by even wanting, by having to talk about it because of what he did to her. It became obvious that, you know, he didn't want to talk about her. So, you know, I was told to be always nice to Richard. Don't get up. Not that I ever did anything to hurt him or, you know, just be nice. Don't confront him.
Right.
Don't confront him.
And that's, I mean, that's part of those John Reed techniques is to get in their space and.
Right. So I said, okay, I'll do what you guys say. I won't confront him, won't get close, anything like that. So I was sitting there and I thought, you know, hey, okay, I'm the second guy on this interview, but this ain't going anywhere. We need to go to the girls in Johnson County. And I said, why don't we talk about the girls in Kansas, in Johnson County, Kansas? So we started talking about them, and he became much more nervous. And during our interview, he caught us in a lie. He figured out the girl set him up from Chicago. It wasn't a big lie, but he started figuring out that who turned him in. He said, you guys are lying to me. I don't know if I should talk to you. And he's getting pretty cocky and loud. And I just basically told him, and I thought about it a long time before I did it, because I had only been a detective 4 years. This is really the first big case, and I'm in on the interview. And so I confronted him, told him to sit down, because he was standing up, you know, and I told him, sit down. Shut up and listen. You're the killer here, not us. So don't try and judge us, you know. And he tried to come back, and I came right back, and he sat down. Never again was cocky about anything. So that opened it up. We talked with him. We'd show him pictures of the girls. He didn't want to look at them. He'd rub his eyes. He'd say, I don't know anything about them. Then he would try to blame Frenchie for it.
Frenchie was the employee that picked him up.
Said that he, you know, he could tell us the whole thing. After, I mean, we interviewed him for, 8 hours? And then in the middle, we had to take him in to get a unlawful
flight warrant,
get that released. So we did that. So we were in there for about 7 or 8 hours with him. And finally he said, what's in it for me? What can you do for me if I tell you the whole thing and I can provide you everything? And we said, well, I don't know. I said, you know, they're not going to deal with you, Richard. You're the Ted Bundy of Johnson County right now. They're not going to give you a deal. I said, I'll call the prosecutor and find out. So I called Paul Morrison. I said, he says he can tell us everything. Give us the girls, everything. He said, but he wants a deal. What can we give him? Paul said, I'm not going to give him anything. I said, oh, no. That's what I told him. And he said, well, tell him that we'll give him his choice of any prison system in the country. That if he wants to go to Alabama, we'll put him in their state's penal system.
Well, did Kansas have the death penalty at that time? They didn't.
No.
Okay. So you couldn't offer life without parole.
Yeah, because he knew, and that was one of the statements he made. He said, everything's in Kansas because I'm aware Missouri has the death penalty.
Yeah, so there's nothing you can offer him.
Right.
You cannot give him anything but life, several life sentences.
Well, and at that time, Kansas didn't even have like the hard 40 and later the hard 50. They just had life, which was 15. You're eligible for parole after 15 or 18 years.
That's where you have to give him three consecutive lives.
Boxcar him.
Yeah.
So,
term, boxcar him. You ever heard that before, Aaron?
Boxcar him?
Boxcar your sentences rather than concurrently.
Yeah, I've heard concurrent versus consecutive.
Well, the boxcar is consecutive.
Yeah.
Well, especially if there's three murders you can tie him to.
Right.
Yeah. So we went back and we talked with them. And I said, you know, Richard, the only thing they'll give you if you want, if I were you, I'd want to get out of Kansas or Missouri prison system. Somebody will kill you just because of your notoriety. Because you're going to be very famous or infamous in the prison system. And I said, people like to kill people like that because that makes them famous. He said, my life's over. I said, yeah, you're right. Your life's over, but you can still do stuff with your life. And I told him about Edmund Kemper, a co-ed killer in California that killed several co-eds. And then he became cooperative after his conviction. And he went and worked with the FBI. And basically what he did is told the FBI what all he did when he killed all these people, plus all these women, and also how he killed them, where he stashed their bodies, because some of them hadn't been found. So I said, you know, you get some privileges for doing that. And he sat there and he thought about it. And we were trying to convince him. Tommy talked to him. We took breaks and Tommy would talk to him. And Tommy, he told you something interesting about his father, didn't he? He tried to.
About his mother beating his mother. Him. I guess it was his stepmother. She would beat him. And every day she would lay out his clothes he had to wear to school. And if he tried to wear something else that he wanted to wear, he would get beat for that. So I'm sure he had a difficult parenting experience.
Well, even if that's the truth. But didn't he say something about his father, what he tried to do with the lug nuts on his father's car?
Oh, did he loosen them one time? Yeah. Just trying to cause his father a problem, took the lug nuts on his car all loose, you know, hoping he'd have a car accident.
How old was he at that time? Do you remember? Is he like a teenager probably?
Would have been a teenager.
Yeah.
I mean, did you talk with him about the murder from that happened when he was 16, or because that he was now an adult and he'd served time? And
we didn't talk to him about that.
You couldn't talk to him about that?
Well, we could, but there were...
You want to lead him in, because you would think if I was... him sitting there in the airport with, you know, these FBI and, you know, the police, you know, questioning me and asking very pointed questions or not, that why wouldn't he just say, hey, I'm not saying anything. Where's my attorney?
Well, that was another thing that you try not to get him to say that. And
he danced around the A word.
Well, he never asked for an attorney.
Did he sign a waiver? Did he sign a waiver?
I never used waivers. I just would give him the oral waiver off the card, and they'd say, because a lot of times it's very hard for somebody to sign something. They'll think that they're admitting guilt. And so at that point, in law enforcement anyway, you didn't have to use a rights waiver. You could just read it off the card that way. So that's what we... Well, to be honest with you, I wasn't even there when he was given his rights, so I don't know.
So the FBI agent did that.
What the FBI did with that, but usually I wouldn't read him. I would read it to them and not have him sign any kind of a waiver. But he was ready to go. I think, don't you?
I think he was real close.
He was ready to confess. We had kind of told him, you know, things are better for you in prison if you cooperate. You can go to a different prison system so they don't know you. He was real close. He said, you know, I'm ready to tell you everything, or he was pretty close. He said, I want an attorney to come in here and tell me what you told me you can do, put me in a different prison system, is the truth. Well, we didn't consider that as an actual invocation of an attorney. So we said, okay, and there happened to be a judge at the police headquarters, a district judge, and by this time it's probably about 11 o'clock at night, and we said, well, he knew what was going on. I said, we need an attorney, so the attorney can just tell him we can put him in a different prison system. So he said, I got just the guy. I'll call him. So we thought, okay, we got a guy coming in, and the defense attorney comes in, he goes in, he's talking with him. I mean, he's in there for an hour, right? At least an hour. And Tommy and I are looking at each other, oh, this just isn't going well when you're in with an attorney for an hour. So the attorney comes out and he says, Mr. Grissom has nothing further to say. And we said, well, what do you mean? He was ready to talk to us. I advised him not to tell you anything. And, you know, we were a little frustrated and irritated, and we said a couple of things to the defense attorney that he didn't like. But anyway, it was done. we couldn't talk to him anymore.
Who was the defense attorney? Was it somebody that Grissom had contacted?
I can tell you his name. It was Paul Shinatona.
Was he
from Dallas?
From Dallas, he was, because that would be the district where you apprehend him and you have him. You're just kind of waiting here to fly him back to Kansas City.
And we really thought that we were going to have an attorney that, you know, would, was kind of a perfunctory thing, go in and talk with him and then assure him what
we had
said, and then come back out and we'd go from there.
And what you said was actually true.
He came out and he says, "I believe him." I thought, oh, you know, I mean, he believed Richard Grissom. So, if, you know, he's the one that, you know, clammed him up, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. The
there's no doubt he did.
Told him. And he was kind of a thorn in everyone's side after that, because then he figured he was assigned to Richard Grissom. We had a
stick with him through extradition. Then you do an extradition process. Yeah. I guess there was a warrant in Kansas by now.
So wouldn't let him waive.
Yeah, and actually, we had a waiver of extradition when, because he was on parole. He had signed a waiver of extradition for being a parolee. So if you violate your parole, you go anywhere in the country, you've signed a waiver, and legally they can take you back.
I didn't know that. I'll be darned. Yeah. So it's kind of a standing waiver of extradition if you're a parolee.
Yeah, but it was
that Kansas State parole system then?
Yeah, but it was decided that
that was on one of those check cases, probably, or fraud cases, right?
And it was decided that probably he was signed that under duress, because if he didn't sign it, he's not going out on parole.
Yeah.
And they said they didn't want to take him back to Kansas City on that waiver.
Yeah, and if you think about
it, I thought it was under duress.
Right. If you think that might be an argument in the future and you have enough to do the extradition, just go ahead and do the extradition. That way you won't have to visit that issue. Otherwise, you'll have at least one appeal up and back down on that issue. So
how long would it take for an extradition then? I mean, so you're sitting there at the Dallas airport in their little security facility.
You know, it worked out. Oh, he went to either Dallas or Fort Worth jail. And it worked out because he was held on the forgery, the parole violation. They hadn't charged him yet with the murder.
Okay, so you got him on the parole violation.
And they knew he was going to have to stay in jail. So what Morrison did is that's when he continued with the task force and was able to get a much tighter case on the three murders. Because he knew he wasn't going anywhere, so he didn't have to charge him yet. And I think it was 2 or 3 months later, he announced that he was charging him with first-degree murder in 3 cases. And it had a real good case. By this time, they had buttoned up a lot of stuff that we couldn't button up at the time because there wasn't the time to do it.
Right. That was a Kansas parole violation. So by that point in time, they'd brought him back to Kansas.
No, he was still on the
parole violation.
He was down there for 3 or 4 months.
Oh, they were able to stretch
arrest.
It out that long. Wow.
Yeah.
Of course, you didn't really care because he's incarcerated.
Right. Well, yeah, he wasn't going
The only thing you cared about was that he was incarcerated.
Right. There was no bond because it was a interstate warrant and there was just no bond on him. So they did... Morrison and did come up with a great idea because this Shinatona kept fighting it. I mean, eventually he's going to have to come back. But after they got the warrant, there was a period of time when Grissom made his appearance in court for fighting extradition that Shinatona was no longer his attorney. It was like an 8-hour, 12-hour time frame. You remember that? And Morrison had sent 2 detectives, Bill Batt from Overland Park and Pat Hinkle from Lenexa, to when after this hearing, and he's being brought back to the cell at the county jail, they took him and brought him back to Kansas City. And, I mean, it was kind of a little deal that they were able to work through the all the red tape, and they got him, and it really, Shinatona was really mad. I mean, he didn't look good. We had kind of faked him out and got Grissom back. I mean, it was all legal. Like, there was an 8-hour time frame where they, what he kept doing was appealing, I think, the extradition
on the parole violation.
He couldn't do it when he was they told him he had to go back to Kansas. He could appeal, but he had like 8 hours or something in between. Well, they hadn't filed that appeal yet, which held him there. So they took him right from
okay.
the court.
Somebody was on the ball there. Yeah. Paul was on the ball. He was watching the procedural, knew all the rules.
Right.
Well, so, but at this point, you're still really just talking about him, you know, being incarcerated and brought back to Kansas on a parole violation. You're still trying to tie him to these murders.
He was, the Metro Squad had, the things he had told us hurt him in court. It was not a confession, but when you tell the police, I can give you, what's in it for me? What does that make you sound like a greedy guy? What's in it for me? What can you do for me? I'll give you everything. I'll give you the girls. I'll give you their bodies. He said, you'll have to dig them up. Everything's in Kansas. Nothing's in Missouri because they have the death penalty. Plus the fact that during the Metro Squad, in Joan Butler's apartment, they found a piece of jewelry which they thought was Joan Butler's. And it went, this was before she was really missing. It was like the second day after she had disappeared. And they brought it back to Wichita thinking there was no evidentiary reason for it. But a very smart detective, Dan Carney with Overland Park, was looking through the property receipts and saw that this, I think it was a necklace that had been, released to the Butler family matched the description of a necklace that was stolen in a burglary of an adjacent apartment. Well, not adjacent, but it was in the same apartment building as Joan Butler's that was stolen. And the burglary occurred the night she disappeared. So they called her the victim of the burglary. She came in. She identified two pieces of jewelry, one that was I think it was like a peso pendant, gold pendant that he had stolen from her that we had received from one of Richard's girlfriends. She turned it in. And also this necklace that was a chain. It was bought in Italy, and Overland Park or Lenexa tracked that down to prove that that was her chain because it was made in Italy. They could prove that.
So apparently the night that he either walked in or was inside waiting for Joan Butler when he got her, he had been in another girl's apartment earlier that night. Right. Boy, she dodged a bullet, didn't she? It could have easily been her.
Yeah. Well, we thought she was the original target. And when she didn't come home that night, he went to Joan when she got home.
That was a fortuitous night she spent with her boyfriend, more than likely.
So that they also on the Teresa Brown and Christina Roush apartment, the lab was able to identify hairs that were consistent with Richard Grissom and no one else in the apartment. They also were able to identify pubic hairs that were in the beds of the two girls. And Richard shaved his pubic hair. So when you get, and I'm not a hair expert, but they can tell when a pubic hair has been cut or it's just fallen out, it just falls out. But these had been cut or shaved, and it was consistent with his pubic hairs because he had not a rare makeup, but he was mongoloid and African American. So there wasn't anybody in those apartments that.
Oh, I see. That would be like Asian, like right. Mongols. You say mongoloid, I'm thinking of.
Well, that's what they describe
as Mongoloid. Right,
but be like Asian and because of for the Mongols. Okay, right. Interesting.
Mongoloid and Negro.
Yeah, that's what it was.
So they narrowed it down to somebody with that, and that's what he was. But it was not on itself, that was not like the smoking gun. That was just what you had was just a whole dozen. Like I said, a mountain of circumstantial evidence that you're describing that the jury had to sift through.
What happened with the stolen car?
It was recovered down in Dallas. And
how'd you find that car? You didn't even know it was stolen for sure.
Tommy found it.
We found it at the airport. you know, when he came in.
How'd you find in a huge big airport like that?
I'm not sure if he had a parking ticket or if he had something on him that led us to that car.
Okay, maybe a receipt. You knew that he was in a particular lot. He had a ticket for a lot.
That might have been it. He had the receipt or a parking receipt with him.
Or you didn't ask him about the car, how he got there maybe, or no? Now, was there anything in the car?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, so you recovered this stolen Pontiac out of Grandview where he had left his other car.
Yes, and in that car, he had, the term we used was a killing kit or a kidnapping kit, you know, that he had duct tape and knives and did he have
rope? Yellow rope, duct tape, knife. Actually, it was
a pellet pistol.
Yeah, the pellet pistol, and it was a knife and then also a box cutter.
Oh, so he had another pellet pistol.
Yeah, he had another pellet pistol.
Wow.
I think the girl from Chicago was going to be his next victim.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Dallas also checked there, because we were in contact with Dallas and really the Texas Rangers, to see if there were any similar murders in Texas in the time frame that he was down there, but we could never find any, or they didn't find any. But it was also discovered when his car was recovered in Grandview, there was a treasure trove of evidence because there was lots of jewelry in there that was the two girls. There was also credit cards in there that were the girls. That was a big find. Also, the fact that he was in Joan Butler's car with the blood evidence, and the lab was able to eliminate the other siblings of Joan Butler, too, that they had never been in that car. So it had to be hers.
And the blood evidence was in the trunk?
Yeah, in the trunk of a rental car.
Odd place, you know.
Yes. Well, unless you're moving.
Dead.
Unless you're moving a body.
Bodies. Yeah. So they had a very good circumstantial case.
Wasn't there was something also about a storage unit that he may have kept those two girls in, or at least one of them, for a period of time. What was that?
Frenchie had decided he remembered about
he all of a sudden later, his memory came back a month later.
About a month later, he remembered that.
You didn't ever file charges on this
you
guy.
You mean when he came back from Dallas and Grisham had been incarcerated and you're waiting for him to come back.
He said that he remembered going to the storage locker, which Grissom used for his business, and he worked for Grissom. He said he went in there, and there was
some wadded up duct tape.
Wadded up duct tape and sunglasses that were left. And he said he took the duct tape and threw it up on the roof, and he kept he said the sunglasses were still there. So they did a search warrant on the locker.
This was a storage locker he kept under another fake name.
Yes.
St. Jose Rodriguez or something like that.
Yeah, it might have been Rodriguez or Cho. He liked Ricky Cho or Yoon Cho. They found the sunglasses. The sunglasses were identified as Christine's. And in fact, they're the ones that she had on when the ATMs took her photo in Belton and Raytown. Oh,
so she probably had been in that storage locker maybe.
Right. And so that was they got hair samples from the duct tape. There was head hair in there.
Oh, he did find the duct tape that he threw on top of it.
It was on top of the roof. It was still there, but because it had been out in the heat and it was a hot summer that year, it had wrecked most of any of the characteristics.
Okay.
But they could say it was head hair. And then they also had a lady come forward that worked at a storage locker facility in Raytown. Now, Richard took Christina to an ATM in Raytown, about no more than a half mile from this storage locker, on the second night. And the lady identified Richard as being with a girl whom she thought was Teresa Brown, and forced Teresa Brown to rent a storage locker in Christina Roosh's name. And so that was a big deal. That happened about a month and a half prior to the going to court. And
that just came out.
Yeah, the lady finally just called Overland Park or Lenexa.
Of course, the storage locker had been re-rented probably.
Right, twice.
Twice.
Had been re-rented twice. But there was evidence that there was blood there at one time. They weren't able to get any DNA or any typing of the blood. But the lady was adamant, and she was a great witness in court. Under cross-examination, they tried to really ruin her identification of Grissom and Teresa Brown. And she was very steadfast and saying, no, absolutely not. That was him, and it was Teresa Brown with her. With
cool.
Him. And this was a storage locker that was big enough to drive a car.
Right.
And this was the lady was the manager of the storage locker?
Yes.
Jacqueline Fite?
Yep. No. Yeah. Is that her? I think that's her. Yes. She was a very strong witness for us. But they also had the profiling unit from Quantico come to explain to the jury why they thought the three girls were dead. They had people, they had Selmark come out and testify, the DNA people. Overland Park and Lenexa just did a great job investigating, and I don't think there's many prosecutors in the country that would have got a guilty verdict on three first-degree murders without bodies, except for Paul Morrison, so... I mean,
he's a go-getter.
Job.
I wouldn't want him after me.
But they never connected him to the murder in Wichita.
Actually, I'm good friends with Kenny Landwehr, and rest in peace. He died a couple years ago. But he told me, along with I have other friends in the homicide unit in Wichita, that they actually have a stronger case than we did up here. They had a body. They had lots of evidence. But we prosecuted Grissom first. I mean, he wasn't going to, he got 360 years before he was eligible for parole. I think the prosecutor in Wichita decided why spend all the money on this prosecution and just didn't do it.
Interesting. So he got found guilty, got 365 years. There was one appeal.
Yeah. I think they had a
overturned.
Theft or a burglary that was thrown out, but everything else they didn't. It was everything.
Nothing to do with the murder convictions.
No,
was
no.
Overturned on appeal. Uh-huh. So he's in the Kansas State Penitentiary system now.
Still
there.
He
never
didn't get a chance to. He couldn't go to Montana or maybe a nicer prison system.
He didn't take that deal.
He should have taken a deal, man.
Now, can you say what prison he's in Kansas?
I think he's in El Dorado. That's public information. You can look him up on what's it called, Casper. But he's in El Dorado prison.
That's a max security.
Yeah, super max.
I didn't really. I've kind of lost track of what's in the last
well,
I
Lansing
remember. Lansing
still
behind
is,
the walls, but, the big prison.
Yeah, El Dorado's I think where the worst of the worst.
The worst of the worst go out there.
So yeah, he's there, and you know they've transferred him from time to time because he is such a I don't want to say dynamic character, but he's very
he's a con man.
He's very good, and sometimes he gets guards on his side, and he does stuff. He gets special favors, and because of this, they transfer him a lot, at least from block to block, or even from prison to prison, because he's such a problem for him. And he gets letters all the time. Women.
That was my next question, because we ran into a deal where this guy was got this woman to actually try to help break him out of the penitentiary. He was a skyjacker, and he got this woman to try to help break him out of prison.
Hijack a helicopter.
She hijacked a helicopter. Now the helicopter pilot took the gun away from her and killed her. And this is a Vietnam vet, man. Yeah. This guy learned how to fly helicopters under more adverse conditions. She didn't bargain for that.
He was really lucky because she had military training. He had military training. He brings the helicopter up to like 5,000 feet and says, you know, slide the door open. It'll be easier for these guys to get out. They're going to land in the minimum part of Marion, Illinois, at the prison.
Oh,
and
Marion.
As she goes to slide the helicopter door open, he grapples with her, and the helicopter pretty much free falls.
But he's high enough up that he can auto-rotate without him doing much, and then he gets her under control. And he
gets the gun and shoots her twice in the head.
And you know, he wasn't like he was a cold-blooded killer. He got the gun, and so she, not to be deterred, this is how bad she wanted to get this guy out of the joint. She says, I've got another gun, and she's ruffling around in a backpack. There's a bag that she's got, and so he goes ahead and kills her then. and he lands. We talked to a guy who was going to be part of this.
We
got to
get that
attempt.
Out. We yeah, really we need do. To get now we that know. They've DB Coopered the story.
Yeah, yeah really.
Now Richard Grissom, though, so he's got he obviously has female fans. He hasn't made any attempts at escaping.
Not that I'm aware of.
It'd be interesting to talk to some of those women, wouldn't it?
Has he ever? Nobody's ever gotten him to say anything more. I mean, here, there's three women whose bodies nobody may ever find if he doesn't come forward and say where they're buried.
Well, I think...
Has there been anything that's kind of, as a cold case, to kind of find these ladies?
You know, the families would love to find
well,
those yeah. bodies.
They're always looking. You know, I mean, every once in a while they get leads or they get somebody will call into tips. And I do know that, I know they've dug up a pool that was... being poured right about the same time that the girls went missing, but they weren't there. They still look. I mean, if something comes in, they look. Both Lenexa and Overland Park. But
can we just for the people listening to this, the girl's name is Joan Butler, Christina Rausch, and Teresa Brown.
Correct.
And there's a number that people could call. Do you know that number? If they had any information,
I would say
or
just call
tips, number?
Tips hotline. If they have any information on
yeah, what is
where
that?
They
417-816.
474-TIPS.
816-474-TIPS. TIPS. T-I-P-S.
Yep. Or you could call the Overland Park Police Department or the Lenexa Police Department. But they still follow up tips all the time. I've gotten called from Lenexa on a couple of addresses. Do you remember that? And I said, yeah. And they said, okay, well, we're going to go dig this pool. I said, okay.
Interesting.
So... you know, they're still active, as active as they can be looking for.
Right.
And Richard Grissom, he's not cooperating
asked,
in any way. Yeah, nobody's come back around to say,
no.
Hey.
Well, I went down there.
Did you go? Yeah, I was getting my question. Did you go interview?
In the mid-90s, I was asked by Overland Park to go down and talk to Richard to see if he would talk to me. And he would not come out of his cell.
Yeah.
And, you know, I told him, I said, he's in prison. You guys can tell him to come up here. And they said, no. He's not going to become. So I said, okay. But yeah, I thought, you know, maybe he would give it up after 5 years where they were. But I think it's the last thing he's got to say, screw you. I'm not telling you.
Yeah.
And he'll probably go to the grave with it.
Do you know how old he is now? I mean, we're talking about this. These murders were in June of 1989.
Yeah.
He was convicted about, what, a year later?
90, yeah. So he would have 26. He's probably 52, 53, something like that.
He might be healthy, but he's not going to live to 300 some
no.
years.
No. I don't think he's that healthy anymore either. So
well, we can only hope.
There was another little... we had a fairly controversial coroner. Actually, he was a forensic pathologist in Johnson County back then. He's since deceased, so... He a very, very colorful guy, very good coroner or pathologist.
But colorful.
Colorful. We were sitting there just before, Tommy and I were sitting there, and there were other guys sitting around in the briefing room late one night. And it was like the first or second night we were there. And he's looking at the reports and looking about the elderly lady that was murdered by him. And he says, you know, this guy is... treats women like trash. He said he is not going to bury him. And in fact, he'll kill. I'm sure he's going to kill until we catch him. And he says, I give you the green light to shoot him on sight.
Well, you know, the coroner, if he was the elected coroner, he is the highest law enforcement officer in the county, I believe, isn't he? Is that right, Tommy?
Some counties, he is.
Technically, the coroner is the highest legal official.
No, maybe it's the sheriff.
Yeah, I think the sheriff. No, actually, maybe the district attorney or the
they
prosecutor.
Say the coroner, there's some statutes where
there's
the
something
coroner
about
is the only one who can arrest the sheriff.
Something like that. Yeah. There's something about that that the coroner has a lot more power than what you would realize.
Well, it was just a very colorful statement. He got,
yes.
We all got a kick out of it. Yeah. He did too. But there's a lot of those.
Yes, there's
there was never really any opportunity for that because at the time that he was apprehended in the airport in Dallas, they took him down, you know.
Right.
Pretty controlled
yeah.
situation.
Oh, yeah. It was a, yeah. yeah. Yeah, it was
controlled. It wasn't like the most recent one in Dallas. So they
No.
We had hopes when we were down there after we got him, and we were thinking that he would waive extradition. We had actually
You could bring him back in the car?
We wanted to drive him back.
Drive him back,
get a lot of time to talk to the guy on the way back.
Wait, had you driven down there, or did you fly?
No, but we were thinking we would drive back.
You could just rent a car and drive him back.
Yeah.
But, you know, you need a little time alone with him. There's actually a pretty well-known case where they did something like that up in Iowa. Iowa, yes. And along the
Christian
way.
Christian burial speech.
Yeah, along the Christian burial speech. Man, you got it down, Joe. I went to law school. I barely remember that one. Yeah, they were bringing this guy back, Aaron, from where they arrested him. He'd killed a kid. And so one of the detectives was a pretty hail fellow, well met, you know, friendly sort of a guy, kind of like Joe here and Tommy. And so he starts talking to this kid, and he says, you know, he said, don't you want to at least give this girl a Christian burial? Her family would appreciate that. And he said, well, yeah, I think that's right. So, you know, they were on the road where he had taken this girl, and they pointed him to where her body was, and they found it. And that got excluded from evidence. You know, when you exclude the body from evidence, that's pretty serious.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, what they told me in law school is sometimes in order to protect everybody's rights, you have to take some of the most horrendous case. I mean, it can be the most horrendous case in the world and say, you know, this is how fair the law is. We will let this guy go.
Right.
Rather than violate your rights, Joe Langer, your rights, Tommy Robinson. And you know, there's some.
But you cannot expect any rights of privacy or confidentiality sitting in the back of a squad car.
Well,
no, what it was, they hadn't read him his rights, and he was a kid, wasn't he?
He had invoked, but so you're really not supposed to talk to him as far as questioning him, and they really weren't questioning him, but they kept
just
saying
chatting
it was bad weather, it was a blizzard, snow was falling, it was icy. The detectives, you know, he kept saying, you know, that poor little girl's laying somewhere. Her family sure would like to be able to bury them and give her a Christian burial, and kind of pulling at his conscience. If he obviously must have had somewhat of a conscience, and he finally broke down and said, "Pull over here. I dumped her clothes here," and took him out to where the body was. But
which is fortunate, because in many of those instances, the body disappears and they never find it.
Yeah.
In the case of Richard Grissom.
But he, we kind of went a little, well, Richard never invoked anything. So we kind of went at him with the Christian burial speech a little different. But
yeah, but he hadn't invoked like that.
No, he hadn't invoked.
I'd kind of forgotten.
I mean, you can use
to actually
that.
Invoke.
It's legal to use it. You just, not after the invoke.
Now, does he, attorney. As far as him being at the court hearing and everything, he still claims to be completely innocent?
I don't know if he claims that.
Or he just didn't say anything.
He was just, he's never really, he never took the stand.
He never took the stand.
He never really talked anything about it. So.
Right. You know, and that's an interesting, that the way you frame that, Aaron, is like he claims to be innocent. Mostly people, they don't really claim to be innocent. They just plead not guilty and they don't have to testify against themselves. So then the state has to prove it beyond reasonable doubt. Which is why that lawyer told him to not talk to you anymore, because you were going to use everything that you could in when he started talking to you. And you didn't have a body. He knew by then they didn't.
Right.
You didn't have the bodies, and so you really needed him to tell you something.
Well, we thought it was going to happen, and it didn't.
just as a kind of a recap here. From your experience on the case. Can you give what you would say is your estimation of just really what went down in terms of how he killed Joanne Butler and Christina Rausch and Teresa Brown? Do you think?
Yeah. Any theories on
how that went down? I mean,
how
you said
it went down and where the bodies.
Tommy
went.
Says he's got a raper kill kit in his car.
Oh, and by the way, that the kill kit that Tommy recovered from the stolen car in Dallas is in the museum at Quantico at FBI headquarters.
Oh, really? They're using it, huh?
Yep.
Interesting.
So, it's hard to say. You don't know. You know, he could have done many things with the bodies. You know, I think, you know, there were all kinds of wild claims on what he could have done with it when it he was first arrested. But a lot of those have been debunked. My opinion, for whatever that's worth, I think he had different storage lockers throughout the metro area. And in those storage lockers was painting equipment, which would include tarps. I think what he probably did is put the bodies in tarps and then put them in a large dumpster that you pick up and they go in and they can take them out to the dump and do the same thing, lift it up. Nobody ever really sees it. And
just like a commercial dumpster, he'd put the bodies
right
in there.
Yeah, and the thing comes around, picks it up, dumps it in. Nobody really looks if they're in wrapped up in a tarp.
Yeah, you just go back of a business.
Right.
And
although he dismembered his grandmother.
No. But he mutilated the girl in Wichita.
But really didn't dismember.
What about the woman that he killed when he was a juvenile?
Yeah, when he was 16.
Do you remember any details about how he handled that?
He beat her with a railroad spike, and I think he may have stabbed her, too. I can't remember. I know I thought he beat her to death with a railroad spike.
So, you
know,
but he just left her body there?
Yeah.
He just left and left her body there? And that's,
right.
That would have been how they made him on it, probably?
Well, they followed him. They were able to trail. It was in the winter.
Oh, really?
They were able to trail him right to the house.
I did that to a burglar one night.
From the house to his house.
Did you ever do that, Tommy, trail a burglar in the snow? We did that one night. We go, knock on the door, and we go in, and the mom answers the door, and it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, and she said, well, my son's upstairs asleep. I said, well, look at all that.
Yeah.
Where that snow is melted on the floor and it leads right up to the upstairs. And she turns, she says, Jason or whatever his name was, get down here. And he appears at the top and he's, well, I didn't do anything.
His feet are wet.
Come on down. Yeah, we go up and find his wet shoes and the whole nine yards.
You know, he in his car in Texas, he also had a hammer. You know, I fear he probably stabbed and or bludgeoned the girls.
You think he killed, what about Joan, the first one, Joan Butler, Tommy, you think he killed her at the apartment that night, or did he take her out somewhere?
I think he probably took them all somewhere. I think he stayed the night at the apartment with her, but I don't think he, I mean, there was
spent
no
some
evidence.
Time with her there, but he didn't kill her there because you would be blood spots or be some kind of
there'd be evidence,
and there wasn't really that evidence. So he always took them out of the apartments. He got him under control and then took him out of the apartments and took him somewhere else and then probably killed him there.
Probably to a storage locker.
Yeah.
You know, he may have storage lockers we don't know about
right.
or didn't know about at the time. But.
Yeah, he certainly had that Routs girl in that one storage locker.
Right. And he definitely enjoyed killing women. I mean, he enjoyed that. Now, there are people that kill people that do it in rage or they feel it's a necessity. It doesn't bother them, but he liked it.
He liked it.
I mean, there's no doubt he liked killing women.
And there was never anything else when you guys were, you know, like cold cases of similarity?
You know, I got calls from Nashville where we had a girlfriend. And Modesto, California, and I'm sure Overland Park got several, or Lenexa, both, about women. You know, it was on TV a lot. Mm. And he was pictured. And there were a lot of agencies that called because their composites would look like him. But then there were agencies that called that had an MO that was very similar to the girl in Wichita. Because we really don't know how he killed the girls up here. But the girl in Wichita, there was some similar MOs out of Nashville and one in Modesto. But they could never make any cases. So, and he did travel when he was a nationally ranked racquetball player. And so he did travel a lot. And in fact, when we were in Texas, we talked with the Texas Rangers to see if they had any old cold cases or even cases that were new that occurred when he was down there. So I'm sure there's more than what we know of.
Well,
and the families do you ever hear from them?
Actually, everybody on the squad became fairly close with the families. They were very nice. You know, it was just, you know, it's one of those things you're close And even afterwards, you're close, but then you kind of
drift
lead
away,
your own
yeah.
life.
Yeah.
So.
And they lived down in Wichita. And
well, the Butlers lived in Wichita, but the Rouches lived in Overland Park, and the Browns lived in Raymore.
Oh, she was dating a Johnson County Sheriff's deputy, wasn't she?
Yeah.
And what about the guy I'm looking here in the notes? Marcellus Thibodeau.
That's Frenchie.
That was Frenchie.
Yeah. Do you know what ever happened? What became of him?
No, to be honest with you.
He just kind of fell away after he came forward and presented some additional information that he remembered.
He was a pretty key witness.
In the end, did he testify?
Yes.
Did he tell you everything he knew, you think?
You know, I wasn't involved that much in getting information from him, but the two detectives that worked him, I think they pretty much got
They got whatever he knew.
Yeah. Bat and Hinkle, they...
It wasn't like Grissom really took him into his confidence to actually be part of the killing or be that close to the killing, maybe only as the ride back from Lawrence, and then he lied to him about what the problem was in Lawrence.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, there's an interesting thing about Grissom that we found out during the follow-up investigation. He lived with a guy or was very close to a guy and who told us that Richard was, you know, he was a big and imposing character. He looked very tough. And this guy told us when he's in bars, you know, he'd go up and kind of bully his way into talking to a girl that might be with a guy. And he said usually the guys would just leave. But if somebody went after him or, you know, stood up for themselves, hey, you get out of here, he might push it and then there's a fight and Richard would always flight. And
he said,
him and his friend said, we always had to fight his battles because he didn't want to fight. And he said that Richard took his car out without his knowledge one night and smashed it up. And Richard came back and was telling, and this guy was not physically, he wasn't imposing, this guy that knew him. And he said
Frenchie.
He slapped him right upside the face. No, this wasn't Frenchie. This was another guy. He said he slapped him right upside the face and told him he should charge him or call the police that he stole his car. And Richard just started crying.
Huh.
So he was pretty much a coward. If somebody stood up to him, I know from when he was in jail, he was playing basketball. And, you know, everybody thought he was a tough guy. And there was a convict that stood up to him. He just melted right away.
Huh.
So he likes to kill girls, but he's not too good on anything else.
I think when he was in Texas and Joe was talking with him when he started to get up and try and be a little bit of a bully when Joe got in his face and told him to sit back
down. Yeah, that's
right. He immediately complied.
Yeah, he's a psychopath and he just loves to kill women.
Hmm.
And I don't know. We even did that angle with him about his mother being a prostitute. You know, he probably hated her. And
yeah.
I loved my mom, so
no
that didn't
go,
work
no.
either.
Yeah.
We tried to pull
everything.
Yeah.
Now, I guess I have a question, and that really, really comes down to how these women, I mean, they're dead. Is there something that in developing kind of a profile of Richard Grissom that you could say, well, here are kind of characteristics. Here are things that, you know, if you were in a situation with somebody, not saying that they're Richard Grissom, but somebody else, that maybe these are warning signs.
You know, I don't know.
Do you think he's just that much of a psychopath that he could hide the fact that he was essentially serial killer?
I think he was so good at hiding what he really thought that he could mask it. And lots of women liked him. I mean, they came forward during the Metro Squad, and they just thought he was great. They couldn't believe he would be involved in anything like this. And, it was amazing.
Nobody said, you know, that guy kind of made my hair stand
Couple of women that did.
Did they?
But, you know.
He just seemed kind of creepy.
Yeah.
But primarily, nobody did.
Mm-mm. You know, he was outgoing. He was friendly, you know. He was athletic. The girls liked him.
He didn't look mean or...
No, he didn't look mean. He just looked like he was in good shape. And, he always acted.
And he didn't come across as creepy. I mean, sometimes somebody, you know, they can put on that front of being, but they're a little overly friendly, friendly. And well, so and I what, can't, what girls would describe that, and my wife would describe that, as he's creepy.
Right. I mean, there were maybe a couple girls that we had talked with that said that, yeah. But most of them were just shocked.
Difference between eye contact and the piercing stare of a psycho.
Yeah. He didn't have the piercing stare of a psycho. Yeah. He just made eye contact. Interesting.
Yeah. He was, but he was a coward. I mean, there's no doubt he didn't want anything to do with anything that might cause him a little injury or hurt. It was all about him.
What about his family? I mean, after all of this goes down, and there he is now. He's in the slammer for the rest of his life, and he's adopted, but they're still his family.
As far as I know, I think his dad. I think his dad had pretty much had enough of him. I mean, with the pulling the lug nuts off, I think he tried to start their house on fire once too. Didn't he start the drapes on fire?
Seems like, yeah.
Yeah.
So he had been a problem child growing up.
I think.
And then after the incident when he was 16.
Right. And I can't say for sure because I never talked with him or his wife, but I think after the deal with the lady in Lansing where he killed her, I mean, he was an adult and he was pretty much on his own.
So they didn't really come in play. They didn't sit on the front row at the jury trial and support every day.
Oh, no,
of trial,
no. I don't. That kind of thing. I don't. I never saw him. Yeah. I mean, we were at the trial every day. So,
yeah.
Now, you guys had said earlier on in the episode, you talked about how basically Overland Park and Lenexa.
Yes.
Both said, hey, we got $1 million here to get this guy, whoever he is.
Now, that's what I've heard. I haven't gotten that confirmed, but that's what I had heard, that each chief, John Foster from Lenexa and Myron Skae from Overland Park, went to their city councils. Or the mayor or whoever they go to, city manager.
For authorization.
And they authorized them up to $1 million. I don't think they spent.
Whatever route they took, they didn't spare any expense.
No, spared no expense.
They could have followed one lead, after another instead of sending everybody to different locations.
Now they're flying you around the country and everything. That's kind of unusual.
Do you know how much it
right?
ended up costing?
No.
By the time they put him in the slammer?
No, I really couldn't say. I don't know. I'm sure at trial that came out, how much was spent. But, I mean, they did not spare. I mean, and the other thing, as far as the police department or the chiefs in both Lenexa and Overland Park and their city council, they were never pressuring anybody. You got to get this solved. You know, we're spending it was always whatever you need, you just tell us when we'll get it to you. So they were both... Both agencies were not stressed about us not getting it real quick. Mm-hmm. They just said, we just need to get it, and whatever we need to do, we'll do it.
So, well, and it makes the Metro Division look, obviously very credible in terms of coming together with these multi-jurisdictional resources and ended up apprehending the guy.
And at least in our experience when we went to Texas, every agency we asked for help down there, they were just great to work with.
Oh, yeah.
Even the head of security for American Airlines at the airport there was just anything you need,
And the phone company, remember? Because back then, it was landlines.
Yeah.
So they had to trace it back through a landline if he called out to her in Chicago. We were trying to find if we could get a place where it came from. But they tried their best, but they said, that's awfully hard with a landline. So
then that far
and that quick
the country and that quick. You need I used to do those in the fraud unit.
We should have called Gary Jenkins. He probably could have
put those pin registers on there on her phone and then start trying to trace it back. But it's tough.
But they were
back then. It was
do you really
hard.
Have to keep somebody on the line for like 7-8 minutes like they show on TV?
I don't know. Gary,
what you got to do is you got to get a pattern on them, and then they slowly but surely trace it back. So what they do, like you give somebody a log and say, okay, log in the time that he called. Back then, there was no caller ID or anything.
Right.
So log in the time they called, and then they start, and then several
process
times,
eliminate.
And then they start tracing it back station to station until finally they could get to it. It was really difficult back then.
Yeah.
It's not so hard now. It's
kind
of a no-brainer now. Matter of fact, now that you would have been pinging his cell phone.
Yeah, you got GPS location on him, and you're listening to him through his own phone.
Yeah.
We never tried the NSA back then.
Yeah,
NSA. Had some satellite photos of him down there on the beach.
Yeah.
You guys could have parachuted in.
Yeah. But well, I will tell you, they were every agency that we ever worked with. It was great. And, yeah. You know, one thing that's really odd, I think, is that the Metro Squad is such a good organization, and it helps. It really helps smaller organizations more than it helps the.
Oh, yeah, that's what it's for.
Because we got the Big Brother over on the east side of town in Kansas City, and they're always willing to help. They help all the time. They're a tremendous source of information and people. And, you know, I never had any trouble really with any of the agencies in the Kansas City area. But not only does the Metro Squad help with the homicide investigation financially and with the amount of people that they can accumulate in just such a short time, detectives, but it also brings the metro area together because I'm working with Tommy. I'm working with a guy from Blue Springs I've never met before. So over the years, you work with all these different agencies and people. So in police work, as you guys know, if you know somebody, it's a lot easier to get something done with an agency than if you just cold call them. So I thought that was another benefit from the Metro Squad. But this area, St. Louis, rural Missouri and rural Kansas are the only people in the country that utilize this.
I didn't know that. I didn't realize that.
We talked to the Department of Justice about this. They were very intrigued on how it worked.
I knew they had a mid-Missouri kind
of
a
they've got like a rural
thing.
Squad, and then they've got St. Louis has a Metro Squad.
St. Louis does.
And Topeka, I think, has one, and then Kansas. But we talked to me and John Jackson, sergeant with Kansas City
Cold
PD.
Case, yeah.
Yeah. He was in charge of the Metro Squad at the time, and we went and talked to the Department of Justice. They loved it. They loved the idea. And they said, well, what are the rules? And we told them the rules are the host agency pays for lunch and dinner, gas, any expenses, like if you need an airplane or a ground penetrating, they pay for all that. But all the overtime is paid for by the agencies that employ the detectives that come. And you can a small agency with three officers can have 30 pretty well seasoned detectives the next day working a murder in their city. And they were just flabbergasted. I said, well, what are the other rules? We said, well, that's basically it. You know, I mean, you call it out. It has to be approved by the people
like
that are on the Metro Squad board, and then they get 3 days first, and then you have to get extensions, which have to be approved by the board. I said, that's it. They said, well, there has to be more to it than that. I said, no, that's really all there is. They couldn't believe it. They said, well, you got to have more regulations and stuff like that. I said, no.
But you guys, you work in pairs.
Right.
So only one person gets to go in the room. You didn't tell them the rule about flipping the coin.
Yeah. Oh, and when you interview somebody, if you got some jerk FBI, I shouldn't say that. You got some FBI agent there that demands that he's going to be the interviewer. You don't. You have to flip a coin, see who goes in.
If the coin flip worked for me, not for Tommy. Even though he wanted two out of three,
If Tommy had been there, he'd got a confession, Joe.
I don't think anybody could have done a better job than Joe. But it never occurred to me that I was going to lose the flip.
Well, but and Tommy Robinson, who was an officer from 1971 to 1996, where Joe, you were an officer from 1982 to 2011.
Right.
So, I mean, really almost two different eras in terms of work in the police department and technologies that evolved. And
right. I started in police work a little late, so I was almost 30 before I became a cop. But so Tommy's not that much older than me.
But those extra years in experience, can you tell us something, maybe one of those kind of tips, something that you really learned from Tommy that were like, man, I never thought of that?
Well, just
two out of three. Who would have known?
Yeah, two out of three. Tommy was, well, I tell you what, I had been a detective probably a little over a year when I met Tommy. We worked a big case with him and his partner, Kramer and
Snake.
And it was a lot of fun working with them. They showed me a lot of things that I didn't realize. You know, I mean, when you're young, you got to realize for for new people and that are just getting into investigations, you have to listen and you should learn from everybody you work with. And I will say I learned more from Tommy than anybody, and especially the inner workings of KCPD. And he had such a good reputation with Kansas City and Metro wide that if I needed something and I didn't know somebody, I'd say Tommy would call for me, or I could just use Tommy's name and the doors would open. And a lot of how he put together some tremendous cases. And I learned a lot from that and how to interview people. I mean, we interviewed people a lot together. And I think as a cop, you just need to learn from everybody you work with and adopt what's good for you.
Well, one of the things I think that make a detective successful, and the reason I always preferred to work with Joe anytime I could, is that, you know, some detectives, I'll call them desktop detectives, you know, they spend a lot of time in the office and follow up on their cases. You got to get out and follow up. And Joe was always willing to do that. You know, I think his chief and his sergeant early on in his career gave up trying to keep him in Leawood.
Well, and I will.
Not only wouldn't stay at the desk, he wouldn't even stay inside of Leawood city limits.
You follow the lead wherever it takes you. And he would go wherever the lead took him. Right. You know, if it's not his jurisdiction, and get help.
And I will give credit to my sergeant, my first sergeant in investigations. He did take a chance at getting me in detectives with only 2 years on the department. And he backed me all the way, Craig Hill. And he backed me at every corner. And really, after he found out that I would work instead of screw around, he pretty much gave me free hand. So, and I learned a lot from Craig, too.
And Ronald Reagan is the reason that Joe went into police work.
There's got to be a story there.
He fired him when he was in air traffic control.
Oh, you were part of that, huh?
Yeah.
You got laid off from air traffic control.
Ronnie Reagan busted off the unions. Yeah. That was the beginning of the end of unions. Man.
Well, I also had my best friend's dad was a Minneapolis cop.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Minneapolis, and we used to listen. He was head of narcotics and then homicide and then organized crime. We used to sit as kids, listen to his stories, and that's what I wanted.
He had good stories.
But I did become an air traffic controller first.
In Minneapolis.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually in Duluth, up in northern Minnesota.
Wow. All right. I think we've done this. I appreciate you guys coming here.
It was fun.
It was a lot of fun, and I think we'll probably get a lot of people sharing this one around. I've done all this mafia stuff and a couple of other little things. We did like a Ku Klux Klan. We did an investigation on the Klan one time. But we've not done any kind of serial killer stuff, and I've been wanting to do that all along. We still got to get Troy Cole in here for Bob Burdella.
Oh, yeah.
And he wants to do it. I just haven't got that lined up yet. So, got anything else, Aaron? I ought to do my public service announcement. I have long supported the nonprofit First Call. If you have a friend, relative, child, spouse, parent, or anyone you care about that has a problem with addiction, whether it's sex, drugs, or rock and roll, any kind of addiction, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. And if you're outside the area, go ahead and call anyway. They have a 24-hour-a-day emergency hotline. It's always answered. And you can tell them where you are and what your problem is, and they will steer you to resources in your area. They also have a website, www.firstcallkc.org.
And remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app, $1.99. And you can take your own personal tour of notorious mob locations all over Kansas City. And while you're at it, watch the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, on Amazon. You can rent it or buy it and own it. My good friend Elliot Threet got a copy of the DVD, said he thought it was amazing. And you will too. From the mouth of the men that did it, Gary Jenkins, filmmaker, attorney, author, if he ever gets that book done.
It's getting close.
And podcaster.
All right.
Yeah, I'm going to get that app. My wife
too.
Will enjoy
You got to have an iPhone.
Huh?
It's a long story, but you got to have an iPhone. But you guys got iPhones. Yeah,
She's got one.
Get my app. It's a lot of fun, actually.
What's the name of it again?
Kansas City Mob Tour. Just go to search for Kansas City Mob Tour. Well, this brings us to the end of this evening's storytelling. We'll get this out in a couple of 3 weeks. Good night, folks. Say good night, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Find them online at Twitter @OddOmaticMusic.